this point, it would be good for me to just explain structural functionalism. Tuckett Parsons would say, the way to look at society is to view it as a gigantic organism. Hobbes called it the Leviathan, this gigantic creature. It's an animal. Now, Josh, I'll ask you a question. Define the heart. Give me a definition of the heart, the human heart.
Center of the distribution system, something along those lines.
Very good. But what you told me is not what the heart is. You told me what the heart does. It pumps blood. It distributes blood throughout the body. You told me its function. You didn't tell me that it was a piece of meat. You didn't tell me it was a chunk of muscle. You didn't tell me its character. You didn't tell me what it is. You told me what it does. You're a structural functionalist. When in fact you analyze the human body, you ask questions not in terms of what things are, but in terms of what they do. What does the intestines do? What does the heart do? What does the liver do? What do the eyes do? What does the digestive system do, right? Structural functionalist sees society as a gigantic organism, and each of the institutions of society, the family, the political system, the economic system, all the institutions are basically viewed as organs within this gigantic organism. Got the picture? And therefore, the question is always asked, what does the institution do? In what way, see, in analyzing the heart, you're asking, in what way does the heart contribute to the maintenance of the body? Did you get that? How does it contribute to the maintenance of the system? Not only does the heart contribute to the maintenance of the system, but the rest of the system helps to maintain the heart. They need each other. They live off of each other. So you see the functional interaction between the heart and the rest of the body. So it is when you study a social institution, if you're using the structural functionalist model, you ask, in what way does this institution contribute to the maintenance of society? And to what degree does the rest of society contribute to the maintenance of the institution? Do you follow it? That changes everything. What's more is, what Parsons and people like Robert Merton and other very important structural functionalists would say, is that when a organ in the body loses its function, it tends to diminish in size and significance. Case in point, whales are animals, are mammals. They're mammals. They're not fish. They're mammals. And if you undercut the blubber of a whale, you will find the rudimentary traces of feet. I don't know whether they ever walked around on the beach, but the rudimentary traces are there. The point is, if you have this organ and you never use it, it'll what? It'll basically die away. It'll vanish. People are saying we're still trying to figure out whether the appendix has any real function in the body. Maybe if it doesn't, it will just cease to exist. You know, that in the evolutionary development there will come a time when human beings won't even have an appendix. When an organ loses its function, it diminishes in size and significance. Do you see? And that's the way we analyze institutions. For instance, the family has changed dramatically, primarily because we've become an urban society. At the turn of the 20th century, 70% of the American people were farmers. 70%. We're now down to 3%. Now, the problem with that, here's where economics comes in, that large families are only economically functional in a farm society. Lucky is the farmer that ends up with 10 kids. You know, you can plow fields. You guys go out and plow the fields. You take care of the barn. You can. As a matter of fact, we could figure this out. That every time you have a child, and if you're a farmer, you get about $20,000 richer. I mean, in terms of what the child costs to raise, in terms of what the child earns for you, you come out $20,000 ahead. You can see that the person who has 10 kids comes out $200,000 to the good when the last kid leaves the home. That's not a bad deal if you're a farmer. Once you move off the farms and into the city, everything changes. The reality is, if you're living in a city or in a suburb, you are not an economic asset. You are an economic liability. Did you ever think of yourself that way? You. Did you ever look in the mirror and say, you are an economic liability? Because that's what you are. Without benefit of college, which causes an arm and a leg, you cost your parents, by the time you left home, you cost them, are you ready for this, $150,000. Now, if kids are going to cost $150,000 a piece to raise, you're not going to have a lot of them. As a matter of fact, the size of the American family is down to 1.94 children per family. I love that figure. Every time I give it, I say, my son says to my daughter, you are the 0.94. The size of the family has gotten smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller. That's incredible. Very small families. Very small families, do you see? Why? Because it has no functions. In the agrarian society, kids plowed fields, they milked cows, they had so much work to do. What a kid never said to a farmer father was, there's nothing to do. But if you live in an urban setting, how many kids say, you know, I'm bored, man. There's nothing to do around here. Never happened in an agrarian society. Truth is, everything changes when you move into an urban industrial setting. Everything changes. The economic changes foster. And incidentally, the reason why this movement has come is for material reasons. The Industrial Revolution. The Industrial Revolution created huge numbers of jobs in cities and in suburbs. And fortunately, in this country, the Industrial Revolution occurred with the Agrarian Revolution. There was an Agrarian Revolution. New machinery, the combines, the harvesters, the tractor, all this new machinery came in so that a farmer could by himself farm a couple of 100 acres, 300 acres of land. I was up in Canada where they do a lot of wheat farming, and there was a 27-year-old kid and who was a farmer. And I said, how many acres do you farm? And he said, 10,000. It's all wheat. I said, 10,000 acres. I said, how many employees do you have? He said, it's just me and my brother. 10,000 acres? Yeah. The technology of farming has made it possible for very few farmers to produce huge amounts of food. I said, we're down to 3% of the population that's into farming. We're producing more food than we ever produced in the history of this country. The Agrarian Revolution was taking place, driving people off the farms, at the very same time that the Industrial Revolution was bringing them into the city. Do you see the functional relationship between the two? Incidentally, this is a problem because what we often do when we go to the third world as missionaries, and this school is very missionary-minded, send people down to teach the people in third world countries how to farm. Think of the stupidity of that. The result is that you got this huge thing going on in third world countries. We're bringing in tractors and harvesters, and we're driving indigenous people out of work. And they go to the cities. But the problem is that the cities do not create enough jobs to absorb them. Mexico City, which is one of the fastest growing city, if not the fastest growing city in the world, I think the population is up to 25 million now. That's big. Has to create 5,000 new jobs every day simply to absorb the new families that are moving into the city. Can you see an urban crisis here? Can you see a job problem in here? Do you see? We were very fortunate. And a lot of people, when they analyze the third world, don't really get it. Why can't you make the same kind of progress we made in the United States? Because we had an industrial revolution occurring simultaneous with an agrarian revolution. You say, well, the people in the cities need industrial goods. Yes, but they buy them from Japan and China and the United States, and they They can buy them from outside cheaper than they can produce them within the country. It's a mess. It's a mess. We'll get to the issue of fair trade as opposed to free trade a little later on, but it's a mess right now. But we analyze the family, which is where I got off the track. We analyze the family as an organ within an organism. And as the family becomes dysfunctional for economic reasons, you see, as children become economically dysfunctional, even if you weren't a farmer in those days, if you were a blacksmith, your children worked in the blacksmith shop. If you ran a store, the children worked in the store with you. Children are no longer employable. And it's gotten, as the family has become economically dysfunctional, it is what? It is shrunk in size and significance. And there are some sociologists that are saying, maybe the time will come when the family will basically cease to exist. If you mean by family, father and mother and children, we're well on our way. There are all kinds of couples in the inner city. They're just basically sexual agreements. Why did you get married? Not for economic reasons. She turned me on. I got married for that reason. I grew up in a church that was Baptist. You say, what's that got to do with it? Well, we sang this song. Be careful, little hands, what you do. Do you know this song? Be careful, little hands, what you do. Do you know this, Nancy, from Sunday school? God is up above. He is looking down in love. In the primary school, we sang it. Church school, we sang. Did you sing it, Thomas?
Yes, sir.
Be careful, little hands, what you do. I used to... Well, you know, that song ruined my dating life. You know, I'd be in a car, I'm ready to make the move on the girl, and you'd hear this voice from heaven saying, be careful, little hands, what you do. So the day I got married, I was hot to trot. I mean, I was turned on. I was romantically alive. That's why I got married, for romantic reasons. That isn't why you got married in an agrarian society. Ever read the 31st chapter of Proverbs? They read it on Mother's Day. I don't know why. It's totally devoid of any meaning in an urban society. It begins like this. Who can find the virtuous woman? Her price is far above rubies. One time I was lecturing at the University of Pennsylvania, 500 students in the classroom, and I said, I want to introduce you to the role of the woman in the agrarian society. I'm going to quote from the 31st chapter of Isaiah, or rather of Proverbs, and I said, who can find the virtuous woman? Her price is far above rubies. And some guy in the back yelled, what's ruby's price? You know, you know, geez, it's kind of ruined the lecture. You know what I mean? She riseth while it is yet night to prepare food for her household. You're a married woman, aren't you? Do you rise while it is yet night to bake bread? You don't rise while it is yet. The light goeth not out by night, for she is making fine garments for her household. Women don't, you know, make clothes and cook, invent food. It all comes packaged. You buy your clothes at the department store. All of these basic functions of being a wife have been taken away. You only have one role, to be an interesting sexual partner. And if you don't deliver, guess what? They will get rid of you. Please understand, that is the tragedy of our time. How many men get rid of their wives because, well, you know. You see, Kate Millett, the feminist, was right. A 45-year-old man is mature. A 45-year-old woman, she said, is obsolete. And what she meant by that is not that you can't be attractive at 45. She meant you can only be attractive if you're 45 if you don't look 45. And there's a whole cosmetic industry out there that's working overtime to get women to look younger than they really are, you see. It's this kind of world, the dysfunctionality of marriage. And so, in fact, we get rid of... I'm so... intrigued with concerns about the Islamic faith. You know, say, they believe in polygamy. Well, so do we. The only difference is that we believe in what sociologists would call serial polygamy. We have multiple wives, we just don't have them at the same time. Right? Is this not true? And maybe it's more responsible to keep the old one, even when you add the new one, which is what the Muslims sometimes do. Because if you get a divorce and you're an urban woman, the chances of you dropping below the poverty level is so great. It's so great if you're a woman and you get dumped by your husband and you got two kids and, yeah, he's going to give you child support, but he's going to cheat. And it's awful. It's just an awful world for women who are divorced and dumped. It's scary indeed. Which intrigues me, because the church is so upset about gay marriage and has become very accepting of divorce. Very accepting. And probably not a one of you belongs to a church that forbids divorced people from getting married. I got to tell you, when I was a boy, all the churches in my neighborhood would not allow people who were divorced and remarried to become members of the church. Sheesh. We've come a long way from that. Jesus never talks about homosexuality. He's very specific about divorce and remarriage, isn't he? And I always say, you know, like when I do a television show and this comes up, I always say, look, the family is in trouble. But it's in trouble because it's dysfunctional and people are getting divorces. It's the heterosexuals that are getting divorces. The gays want to get married. If that is an ironical twist, I don't know what is. So there we have it. The families become dysfunctional. Does it begin to explain why divorce becomes increasingly prevalent? Why family disintegration has become the hallmark of our times? Do you understand why families are in trouble? And it's not simply a matter of we don't have enough strict preaching in this day. The truth is there are economic forces at work here. And that's what a structural functionalist would do. How does the economy interact with the family? How does the family interact with the family? In what way do they contribute to each other and sustain each other? And dysfunctional institutions diminish in size and significance and may eventually go out of existence completely. One thing that is very encouraging these days when I talk about money from the public sector is the Bill Gates Foundation. This foundation is doing incredible stuff. It's putting money into education. About 5 years ago, Bill Gates decided that they were going to do something for urban education across the country. So they picked, I think, 50 schools that they were going to pour huge amounts of money into and bring them up to snuff, just to see what can be done in one city. And we were very pleased to say, with one exception, we are going to give Eastern University the money to establish a high school in the city. So we have a high school called Eastern in the City. If you go down to 10th and Spring Garden is Eastern University. And during the day, it's filled with high school students. And I went down there to meet them, and they're almost all African-American and Hispanic. And they are bright, and they are intense. And the money is being spent, and these kids are getting a quality education. Incidentally, quality education is not being given because there is an unspoken belief that these inner city kids just haven't got it intellectually. Let me tell you about a story that needs to be told. In Camden, New Jersey, where our missionary organization has a work called Urban Promise, about 8 or 9 years ago, at least that, I suggested to the director of that program, Bruce Main, that we start a high school. We already had an elementary school. Start a high school. And so they started a high school. And the people that came into this high school were people who, for the most part, had been missing school like day after day after day. Most of them were failing incredibly. I mean, you wouldn't believe the level of failure. And that's hard to do in the Camden High School system, to fail. They were failing. They had very poor reading skills. Most of them could not read above a fifth or sixth grade level. We took 30 of them. We put them in a basement of a church. Had them sit around a table, five to a table. We had volunteers come in who never taught. But you don't have to be a great teacher to use the homeschooling materials. You've heard of homeschooling. And there's a whole industry now that is producing homeschooling materials so that people who are not equipped to be teachers can, in fact, get individuals to learn. And we're saying a bunch of fundamentalists are pulling their kids out of the public school and homeschooling them because they don't want them infected with secular humanism. Jeez. National Education Association points out that over 70% of the teachers in America are regular attenders at religious services. If I was a secularist, I'd be scared to send my kids to schools like that. All these religious people running around. But that's the myth anyway. The teachers are secular humanists. So they say, I'm going to homeschool my kid. And they're finding that homeschooled kids do very, very well. They tend to be above the national average. So we said, okay, if they can do it, we can do it for inner city kids. So we took these kids, almost all of whom, I think all of them may have come from single parent homes, living below the poverty level, doing terribly in school. 30 of them. Six tables, five to a table with a teacher volunteer. At the end of the first year, one kid had missed one day of school. All the rest had perfect attendance. I asked one of them, I said, how come you have perfect attendance? How come you come to school all the time? You never used to. Hey, man, you try to miss around here, Miss Jones gets everybody in the car, and they come over to your house, and they get you. The second thing is that at the end of 3 years, all of these kids, all of them, went on to institutions of higher education. One of them got a free ride at Cornell, an Ivy League school, not because she was black, not because she was poor, but because her SAT scores were 1475. She had moved from reading on about a fifth to sixth grade level to this. Don't tell me that these people cannot learn. Don't tell me that these boys and girls are different. These kids are getting shortchanged. That's the reality. And so the school continues. It's called Homeschool Academy. It was that kind of thing that really interested Bill Gates. So, I mean, there are ways of attacking the problem, but that's why we're in this course, because we're not in here just to learn about the city. I mean, you could get that out of the textbook, and you got the textbook. You can learn everything out of the textbook. You don't have to come here for that. What we're here to do is to say, here are the messes. Here are some of the causes of the messes that the book didn't deal with. And thirdly, here are some ways that we might be able to address these problems and how the church can become the lead institution. Namely, instead of the government changing the cities, instead of the private sector changing the city, what about the church changing the city? And I'll tell you why it has to be the church. Not it should be, why it has to be. If you were to go into Camden, if you were to go into North Philadelphia, if you were to go into the Kensington area of the city, this is what you would find. The church is the only institution that's left. Everything else has moved out of town, but there are churches that are still there. The churches can become the means for rescuing the city, and if they don't become the lead institution that facilitates change, question is, what other institution is there? What other institution is there? So I'm really hoping that you will not only learn about urban society and the problems of the city, but you will, as people called of God, say, Lord, how can I go into an inner city church and become part of that church and make that church into an instrument of change? Now, I always say to students, you are already turned on to that kind of stuff, or else you wouldn't be in this course. But when I'm out speaking at colleges and universities, especially if I'm at a seminary, I'm saying, why would any of you want to go to a boring suburban church where the church is a relatively insignificant institution in the community? Let's face it, the dominant institution in the suburbs is the shopping center. Kids do not hang out at church. They hang out at the shopping center. It's where life is. And not too far from here in Plymouth Meeting, what happened is a church closed down and moved into the shopping center. They actually bought a store and set up church there. Because if this is where the people are, this is the dominant place. Everybody, I mean, this is what controls people's lives. Let's minister where people are. They're in the shopping center. Makes sense. Point being, why would you want to go to a suburban church when you could be in a lead institution? And by the time we finish this week of lectures, I hope you can see the potentialities of the church. It's able to do incredible good with very little in the way of resources. Another question. Yes?
What's the relationship of a program like that to the rapidly expanding retiring population and how they get involved? How do you see that demographic getting involved in this?
The question is what to do about this in relationship to retired people. It's about time we start challenging retired people not to retire. We have to be careful on this because the Bible is quite clear. Retirement is against the will of God. That's not my theology. It's Jesus' theology. Let me give you exactly where he addresses the issue. A certain man wanted to prepare for his retirement. So he built a barn and he filled it with all kinds of stuff for his retirement. I don't know what he filled it with, IRAs or hedge funds. I don't know. He filled the barn. But there's inflation in the land. And he's saying, I've got enough now. But inflation, I don't know whether 10 years from now, I know what I'll do. I'll tear down the barn. Remember the story in the Bible? And I'll build a bigger barn. And he fills the bigger barn. And then he says, well, that's it. It's time to retire. That's what it says in the Bible. It's time to retire. Take ease, my soul. You got everything you need. And the scripture says, thou fool, this day thy soul shall be required of thee. Woo! In short, here are all these older people with competence, with gifts, with experience, and they're playing golf, a game where you chase a little white ball because you're too old to chase anything else. Jeez. Most inner city churches have a lot of old people in them. You go into an inner city church, you're going to find old people. You can just talk. Do you live around here? No, I live out in the suburb. Well, why do you come here to church? Well, I grew up in this church. I got married in this church, and my husband, I buried him from this church, and I want to be buried from this church. Jeez. And that's who's there. And there are retired lawyers and accountants. One of my best friends was one of the most prominent lawyers in Philadelphia, and he took an early retirement. And he is having a ball, doing all kinds of stuff, working down at Cornerstone Christian Academy, a nursery school we started in Philadelphia, working with seminaries to try to get them to connect with urban situations. I mean, he is at work doing incredible stuff. When we get to economic development, we'll get to exactly that again. Businesses fail. So if you start a small micro business in the inner city in order to help create some jobs for people there, it's going to fail. There's an 80% probability it'll fail unless it has expert consultants. McDonald's doesn't fail even in the inner city because of its consultants team that troubleshoots, that keeps us eye on what's going on. What if you had a group of retired people in a church serving as a consulting team to a business that's operating out of the basement? The probability of the thing succeeding would be enhanced dramatically. Retired people could be very, very intensely involved. It's about time that retired people say, I think I'll move into the city because I want to be a missionary. There are these neat churches all through the community. I was talking to a pastor. His congregation come from 19 different postal zones. 19 different postal zones. Well, this guy cannot minister to the community because just to make the hospital calls, he's probably got 15 different hospitals he's got to go to in the course of a week. Doing visitation to his members or her members is such that you're not going to have any time left to minister to the community. And the people who are members of the church aren't going to minister to the community because they don't live there. And so these churches sit there, bastions of religiosity, not touching anybody in the neighborhood round about them. I think you will find this in every urban community. I belong to an African-American church in West Philadelphia. I drive in. Most of the members drive in. The biggest problem we have is parking. People know not to drive anywhere near Mount Carmel on Sunday morning because the only thing we can do is double park all over the place. There's no other way to do it. In short, I would contend that the greatest untapped source of missionaries in this country are people who have been retired. I point out this. People between the ages of 55 and 60. Got that? 55 and 60. When I was 55, I didn't consider myself old. I said, I'm middle-aged. And my wife said, how many 110-year-old men do you know? You know, 55 is young. Between 55 and 60, 30% of all people have retired in that age group. Have retired. 30% have retired. I mean, these people are still in the prime of life, and they're retired, and what are they going to do? Man, I was down in Florida speaking at a conference on Thursday. I was just along that Gold Coast, building after building after building, filled with retired people who were basically contributing nothing and demanding everything. This has got to change. Strange as it may seem, and I'll end on this, gangs are a sign that the city's making progress. That's how sociologists look at things. They suspend their moral values and say this is progress. Gangs are evidence that people are getting organized. The only answer to the gang problem is once the progress begins to take place and gangs begin to form, what the task of the church is to create positive functions for gangs. For instance, in two situations where we were dealing with gangs, we started small micro businesses, little factories, the t-shirt factory over in Camden. And we got a gang and said, you can sell drugs, but you're not going to make much money at that. Let me repeat that. That probably came as a shocker, didn't it? You can sell drugs on the corner, but you're not going to make much money at that. How much do you think is the average income of the guy on the corner that's selling drugs? Take a wild guess.
$5 an hour.
$3.85 an hour. Say, why do they do it? Because they all dream of moving up the system. See, there's a pyramid of the suppliers all the way to the top. People up at the top are making huge amounts of money. And so you put up with this. But it's the guy on the street corner that gets shot in the drive-by shootings. It's the guy in the street corner that's risking his life selling the drugs. All the risks are taking. There's a book called Freakonomics, which explains all of this. Have you seen that book? And in it, it's a really interesting book because it asks obvious questions. And the question that he asked was this. Why is it that almost every drug pusher on the corners of the streets are living with their mothers?
Cheap.
They're all living with their mothers. Why are they living with their mothers? If they're making so much money, why are they all living with their mothers? Because everybody he interviewed was living with his mother. And he found out these guys weren't making enough money to live on their own. And that's when he began to analyze the situation. So your gang can move in a negative direction or a positive direction. I don't know how many of you know the name Nicky Cruz. He was a very famous gang member. A book was written about him and Wilkerson, the Cross and the Switchblade. You remember that book? This guy was a gang member, a vicious gang member. But the day he went forward to give his life to Christ, he didn't go forward. His whole gang went forward, you see. Because once you understand the dynamics of a gang, you realize that in gangs, people lose their individuality. They function as groups. Sociologists would understand this. This is why it's so difficult very often to do mission work in a pre-literate society. Because we always think of winning individuals to Jesus. The truth is, in pre-literate societies, you can't win people to Jesus. The whole tribe becomes Christian at the same time. Whatever the chief decides, that's what's going to happen. And you have what in missiology is called people movements. Not individuals are converted, groups are converted. And that's true with gangs.